Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies, who assesses the potential positive and negative consequences that could result from the current Palestinian bid for statehood at the United Nations. Dr. Kathy Grace of the Children's Defense Fund, who examines the consequences of congressional and White House plans to make deep cuts in federal programs assisting the poor as the number of Americans living in poverty reaches a 52-year high. And Arthur Stamoulis, Executive Director of the Citizens Trade Campaign, who explains why his coalition is opposed to President Obama's call to pass free trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Cambodia's President Hun Sen, facing a cutoff of World Bank development loans, has agreed to set aside land in the capital city of Phnom Penh for people evicted to make way for a Chinese-financed luxury development. In mid-August, under growing pressure from housing activists opposed to the massive Bong Kok Lake project to build high-end housing and shops, the World Bank voted to cut loans for new development projects. However, the World Bank will continue to fund $350 million in existing health and education projects in Cambodia, one of Asia's poorest countries. Reuters reports over 15,000 city residents have already been evicted from their homes to make way for the Chinese-financed housing and shopping development. Land seizures that result in homelessness are among Cambodia's most pressing human rights issues. Property deeds and other land records were mostly destroyed under the Khmer Rouge's genocidal regime in the late 1970s. According to the Guardian newspaper, housing groups in Cambodia say residents in the development zone are denied due process in eviction claims or asserting property rights in violation of World Bank policy. Each year in Cambodia, an estimated 30,000 people are forced to move off their land to make room for real estate development, mining, and agricultural projects. On August 31st, Australia's High Court ruled that a controversial policy to send asylum seekers to Malaysia was illegal, but Prime Minister Julia Gillard is now trying to revive the plan. Gillard wants to send 800 asylum seekers to Malaysia in return for accepting 4,000 refugees from Malaysia. Gillard stated the government would revive the Malaysian deal and would circumvent the objections of the High Court by altering the country's migration laws. According to the Guardian newspaper, Gillard's move to breathe new life into the plan came as a new poll indicating her approval rating had fallen to the lowest for a prime minister in the past 17 years. The few thousand asylum seekers that come to Australia annually stir intense political debate over border security. The goal of the plan is to deter smugglers who traffic migrants on a dangerous journey via leaky fishing boats from Indonesia, sending a message to refugees that they will not be guaranteed resettlement in Australia. Gillard's prior proposal included an offshore processing center in Timor-Leste, but were scrapped when the Timorese government declined the arrangement. The plan to change the migration laws, slated to be introduced in late September, faces difficult passage through Parliament and requires support from the Conservative opposition, which so far has criticized the Malaysian deal. A decade after the Honest Tea Company started up in a kitchen to create a healthier, organic alternative to sugary soft drinks, Coca-Cola bought out the brand and more than tripled the number of supermarkets selling the drink. 3 years after joining Coca-Cola, Honest Tea founder Seth Goldman told E! The Environmental magazine that the merger with the beverage giant has taken organic products mainstream and made them accessible to millions of American shoppers. But for many Honest Tea customers, the sale to Coke was the same as selling out. Honest Tea is one of a growing number of small, socially responsible companies to get gobbled up by corporate America over the last 15 years. The buyouts were partly driven by federal organic standards and high profit potential in natural foods. The list of companies includes Ben & Jerry's, bought by Unilever, Tom's of Maine, taken over by Colgate-Palmolive, and The Body Shop, swallowed up by L'Oreal. Gary Hirschberg, co-founder of Stonyfield Farm, which was bought out by yogurt giant Danone Group a decade ago, insists the problem of global warming is just so severe. We need to harness the power of capitalism at a very big scale. But Jeffrey Hollander, founder of the natural household products firm Seventh Generation, has so far resisted the urge to go corporate. He notes corporate acquisitions of green companies rarely make news, and few details that might clash with consumer expectations are released to the public. He observed these green companies will forever be making compromises, balancing profitability with doing the right thing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Mahmoud Abbas, chairman of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, or PLO, and president of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, is traveling to the opening session of the United Nations in New York this week, where he says he intends to apply for membership as the world's 194th state in the UN Security Council. If he does, the U.S. has promised to use its veto to defeat the proposal. Further, the U.S. Consul General in Jerusalem, Daniel Rubenstein, has stated that the U.S. would cut aid to the Palestinian Authority if the PLO moves ahead with its UN bid for statehood. Abbas, also known as Abu Mazen, has the additional option of making an application in the UN General Assembly to advance the PLO's status from observer entity to observer state, encompassing pre-1967 Palestine, including Gaza, all of the West Bank, and East Jerusalem, territory that many previous UN resolutions recognize as illegally occupied territory that Israel must leave. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Phyllis Bennis, a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of books including Understanding the Palestinian-Israeli Conflict, A Primer, and Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. She explains that any decision the Palestinians make can result in both positive and negative consequences. Bennis also points out that the situation is complicated by Israel's boots on the ground in occupied Palestine, with more than 500,000 Jewish settlers living in the Israeli-controlled West Bank and East Jerusalem, and a heavy military presence throughout the territories.
The situation on the ground, obviously, is militarily occupied. It is filled with more than 600,000 illegal settlers. These are Jewish Israeli settlers who live in Jews-only settlements, who are violating international law every morning simply by waking up in their own beds. This decision in the UN is not going to change that. It's a political move, and it does two important things and raises two important dangers. The positive things it does is, number one, and probably most important, it challenges the idea that the only game in town is the Washington-backed 21-year-long failure of a so-called peace process. That hasn't worked for 21 years. There's no particular reason to think it's going to work anytime in the future. So this says, once and for all, the venue for Palestinian-Israeli diplomacy is the United Nations, not the State Department. Number two, even if what I believe to be the more likely decision is made by the Palestinians to go not to the Security Council, where the U.S. certainly will veto a membership bid, but rather I think, regardless of the fact that Abu Mazen says he will go first to the Security Council, I don't think he will. Possible, but I think he will go first to the General Assembly, where the request will be not for membership, but for recognition as a non-member state. The significance of that is not so much within the UN. It means the Palestinians would still not be able to vote, for example, in the General Assembly. They wouldn't be a member. But it means that the UN has recognized them as a state. Member or non-member is not so important. If you're a, quote, state, you can join other treaties. You can sign the treaty, for example, to join the International Criminal Court. That means that in theory, and again, all of this has far more to do with political will of various parties than it does with the official move. But in theory, it means that the Palestinians could join the International Criminal Court, giving the court jurisdiction over its territory. As a signatory to the International Criminal Court, the Palestinians could begin the process of bringing charges to hold Israeli military and political officials accountable for potential war crimes. That's something that has the Israelis and the U.S., we should add, very, very worried. Now, there's no guarantee it would happen that way. All the political realities mitigate against it. But it changes the political dynamic. So those are the two important advantages. One is this question of moving the diplomacy out of Washington and into the UN. Second is the possibility to join treaty bodies like the International Criminal Court. But there are dangers, and there's a reason that a number of Palestinians, some inside the occupied territories, but an even greater number in the diaspora among exiles, are very much afraid of this process and very much opposed to this initiative, because they are afraid that the transition from being represented at the UN by the PLO, the Liberation Organization, that represents all Palestinians, those living under occupation in the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, those living in the refugee camps, those living all around the world as exiles who are unable to return home, that they would no longer be represented, that this, quote, state would represent only those living in the occupied territories, which is less than half of the Palestinian population around the world. The other fear is that the right of return, the right of refugees to return to their homes and be compensated, the right guaranteed in UN Resolution 194, would be abandoned. That's the fear. Now, there's nothing legally requiring this new state, if it came into being, even as a member of the UN, to give up representing Palestinian rights around the world and give up their advocacy for the right of return. The reality is they haven't made any headway on the right of return anyway. But that's the basis for the fear among many, many Palestinians, that they will lose their representation and they will lose the advocacy on the right of return. So there's trade-offs here. This is not an easy call for the Palestinians.
Phyllis Bennis, I know some people hope this might shift the ground enough that there could be a new basis for negotiations. What do you think about that?
No, I don't think this is going to change. The U.S. has made clear that it is not prepared to challenge Israeli settlement, to challenge its military aid to Israel, to challenge the siege of Gaza, to challenge the Israeli rejection of the right of return. The Palestinian move is based on international law and human rights. Exactly the opposite of what the U.S.-led so-called peace process is based on, which is Israeli power. Until that changes, there's no hope for these so-called peace talks. It's simply not going to work.
That was Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Find more information on the Palestinian bid for statehood on the Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The U.S. Census Bureau's recent release of poverty statistics for 2010 revealed that there has been a significant rise in poverty, with 46.2 million adults and 16.4 million children living below the official poverty level, the largest number in the last 52 years. Those numbers translate to 22%, or more than 1 in 5 of all American children now living in poverty in the aftermath of the nation's worst economic decline since the Great Depression. The rise in poverty comes at the same time as both Congress and President Obama are negotiating major cuts in federal social safety net programs such as Medicare and Medicaid. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives voted in April to privatize Medicare while significantly reducing benefits and imposing spending cuts on programs like food stamps and Medicaid. President Obama recently announced his plan to reduce the budget deficit that includes $320 billion in Medicare and Medicaid cuts over the next decade. The plan calls for charging Medicare beneficiaries higher premiums and deductibles while making lower payments to teaching and rural hospitals. Under the president's proposal, homebound senior citizens would now be charged copayments for the delivery of home health services. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dr. Kathy Grace, Director of Early Childhood Development with the Children's Defense Fund. She examines the consequences of congressional and White House plans to make deep cuts in federal programs assisting the poor as the number of Americans living in poverty reaches a 52-year high.
To put some face in reality behind these numbers, we've got also 45% of our children living in extreme poverty, and that's $30 a day for a family of four. So when we think about $30 a day for a family of four, that's not very many groceries. When we actually have children that are going to bed hungry, we don't want to think about that in this country, but we have children who have only been getting meals if they're old enough to attend school, breakfast and the lunch, and then, of course, supper is very limited, if any. And then on the weekends, there's just practically nothing in households for children to eat, much less anything nutritious. So when we're seeing the clothes closet lines growing, when we have people that are involved in being able to go to a free health clinic, and the lines are triple around buildings, that's the reality that we're facing in this country, not a country overseas, but in this country, which I don't know if we just can't absorb that or if we just haven't been able to really grasp the meaning of what this past year, and it looks like continuing through the next year, really means to families, many families in this country.
Dr. Grace, we've had months and months of Congress and the president and now this super committee that's been appointed to talk about deficit reduction, and their task in great measure is to reduce federal programs, including Medicare and Medicaid. What's at stake for the nation's poor in the coming negotiations, especially for children, with the potential of a reduction of these federal programs' benefits?
Well, first of all, everything's on the table. I don't think you could say that any program is necessarily safe. And we also have to talk about poor children, because families, children who perhaps folks have not ordinarily considered to come in this poverty range, are there now. And some folks refer to them as the new poor. So we're talking about a band of individuals from a chronic poverty standpoint, as well as those who have just recently, due to job loss and other circumstances, found themselves in the same category. So when we're talking about potential cuts, we have to protect all programs that can support and enhance the development of children and support those families. We're looking at protecting Head Start at the Child Care Development Block Grant that keeps child care available for parents who are low-income, working, going to school. We certainly have to protect the Medicaid and CHIP programs, because that's literally saving lives every day. We have had a large increase in families and children on SNAP, food stamps, we used to call them food stamps, and of course WIC programs that are helping to support the pregnant women and children under the age of five. And those are just a few that are, as you can tell, critical to individuals actually living and for young children, their development.
During a recent Republican presidential candidate debate, we saw Representative Ron Paul, one of the candidates, asked by the moderator about the government's responsibility to pay for health care for a man who had been in a car accident who was without health insurance. And Ron Paul basically said the man should be allowed to die if he doesn't have health insurance and can't pay for his own health care. That drew a lot of applause from the audience. And a lot of people watching that were horrified. People are questioning really what's going on in this country, where a significant number of citizens in a major political party seems to favor the dismantling of the nation's social safety net, even if it will result in the deaths of large numbers of the poor. How do you respond to what seems to be going on in this country these days?
We seem to have lost the moral compass, and I know people have said that from time to time, but the only way we've lost it and the only way we can get it back is to be more responsive. If we don't respond, then that can be taken as an affirmation or apathy. And I think that it's up to us as a nation to say enough is enough. And if we're not careful, we're going to become totally, I guess I would say, desensitized to this whole idea of human worth.
That was Dr. Kathy Grace, Director of Early Childhood Development with the Children's Defense Fund. For links to additional information on the rising rate of poverty in America, visit our website at btlonline.org. during his September 8th speech before a joint session of Congress promoting the White House jobs program, President Obama called for billions of dollars in spending on infrastructure projects and other government programs to stimulate the creation of jobs in an economy plagued by a 9.1% unemployment rate. During the address, Mr. Obama also called for congressional passage of three controversial free trade pacts, stating it's time to clear the way for a series of trade agreements that would make it easier for American companies to sell their products in Panama, Colombia, and South Korea. The proposed free trade agreements with Panama, Colombia, and South Korea, negotiated under President Bush, have fairly broad support from Republicans. But some newly elected GOP Tea Party legislators who campaigned against free trade may end up siding with many Democrats who have long opposed free trade legislation. Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio, although a strong supporter of President Obama, has condemned the proposed trade treaties. He said in December, "I continue to believe it is a dangerous mistake to pursue the same kind of trade deals that ballooned our deficit and led to massive job loss. I see no reason to pursue more NAFTA-style free trade agreements." AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka has warned that a free trade agreement with South Korea will cost U.S. workers 159,000 jobs, while a deal with Colombia will cost 54,000 jobs. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Arthur Stamoulis, executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign, a national coalition of environmental, labor, and other civil society groups founded in 1992 to improve the North American Free Trade Agreement. He explains why his coalition is opposed to passage of these three free trade pacts and concerns about negotiations on a new Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement.
Free trade agreements are by no means job creation plans. You know, we should have recognized that after the past 15 years plus under NAFTA, under the WTO. And the trade agreements with Korea, with Colombia, with Panama, it's the biggest package of free trade agreements in a decade. The Korea Free Trade Agreement is, in fact, the largest free trade agreement since NAFTA. And these are trade agreements that even the federal government's own International Trade Commission predicts are going to increase the overall U.S. trade deficit. The ITC, the International Trade Commission, doesn't attach job numbers to that, but it makes sense. If you're selling less than what you're buying, if you're importing more than you're exporting, these are going to be net job killers. And just like, you know, every dollar of exports means a potential job in the U.S., every dollar of imports means a potential job loss. And unfortunately, especially with a trade deal like Korea, we're going to be importing more cars, we're going to be importing more high-tech products, we're going to be importing more green-tech products. The high-paying manufacturing jobs and the high-tech jobs that are supposed to represent the jobs of the future are going to be lost under these trade deals.
Now, these were negotiated under the George W. Bush administration. And labor has long said, unless there is protection for U.S. jobs, as well as major protections for workers in these countries, and environmental concerns addressed, that these agreements really harken back to the same problems we saw unfold with NAFTA. What's the Obama administration's stand on really strengthening the position of labor in these agreements and environmental standards that seem to be lacking in these countries, which really lures big companies in this country to move overseas where they don't have to be regulated as much?
You're right. I mean, these are trade deals that George W. Bush negotiated over 3 years ago that he was never able to get through Congress, that President Obama himself campaigned against when he was running for office, and unfortunately has now sort of picked up and dusted off and championed it as his own. The Korea Free Trade Agreement is a trade deal that the Economic Policy Institute predicts, if enacted, Korean imports will cost 888,000 American jobs within just 7 years. Now, obviously, we'll create some jobs due to new exports, too, but nowhere near that many. And again, these are good-paying, high union density manufacturing jobs, high-tech jobs being lost to South Korea, where, you know, it's not a country as bad as Colombia, which is the deadliest country in the world to be a trade union member, and has horrendous human rights violations and labor rights violations. But, it's a country where workers are paid a lot less. And there's actually a provision in the Korea Free Trade Agreement called Rule of Origin that would allow up to 65% of the value of a good assembled in South Korea to come from third-party countries like China, like Vietnam, even North Korea under this trade agreement and to enter the United States duty-free. And that's one reason why, in addition to U.S. unions opposing this, South Korean unions oppose it too, because they recognize this as furthering the race to the bottom and allowing more and more production to move to countries with less and less rights for workers, for the environment, for consumer protection.
There have been talks recently on something called the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement involving many nations in the Pacific Basin. And I wonder if you would explain to our listeners where these talks are headed, what's at stake, and your view on the Obama administration's handling of this new trade agreement being negotiated.
Yeah, so the Trans-Pacific Free Trade Agreement is a new Pacific Rim trade deal under negotiation between the United States and nine other countries in North, South America, Asia, the Pacific Rim. This is the Obama administration's first deal that they're negotiating from scratch. So, there's no excuse. This is the trade agreement that the Obama administration wants. And right now, most of the negotiating documents are secret. What has been leaked suggests that this is very much, unfortunately, a business-as-usual trade deal. And so we've been out there, letting the administration know, trade negotiators know, that we expect a fair deal or no deal, that, we're not going to put up with another NAFTA. One of the big reasons that corporations are pushing for this deal is because they feel Chinese workers are being paid too much. First our jobs went from the U.S. to Mexico, then from Mexico to China, and now the manufacturers are saying, the Chinese are demanding too much and being paid too much. We need to move these jobs to countries like Vietnam and Malaysia. That is a race to the bottom that no working person in any country is ever going to win. That's something we need to reverse. And if we're going to have a free trade agreement for the Pacific Rim, it has to have clear, strong, enforceable labor standards. It needs to have better standards on the environment and consumer protection. There needs to be a clear mandate protecting access to generic medications for sick people. And there needs to be better respect for family farmers. And if we don't get that, we're going to be fighting this trade deal just as hard.
That was Arthur Stamoulis, executive director of the Citizens Trade Campaign. Learn more about opposition to U.S. free trade pacts by visiting our website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut, 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.